Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Christian Science Monitor Daily Program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Today's issue is dated Friday, December 12th, 2025. I hope you enjoy the program. I'm going to begin with the introduction by Linda Feldman, the Washington Bureau Chief. NVIDIA Corp. hasn't been a household name until fairly recently, and now with a major policy change by the Trump administration, it's a must-know. NVIDIA creates advanced computer chips that are critical to the development of artificial intelligence. President Donald Trump has just done a 180, allowing the company to sell its chips to rival China. In exchange, the U.S. government will get a 25% share of future sales. As Caitlin Babcock explains today, the deal hinges on a calculation that China will become dependent on U.S. chips and unable to produce its own. If AI is the future, the stakes could not be higher. I'll begin the articles today with Caitlin Babcock's article, U.S. NVIDIA Chips to China? What does that mean for the AI race? During the Cold War, the U.S. policy on export controls for advanced technology meant that the United States prevented sales to adversaries to stifle competition, as rival countries vied to explore space and develop nuclear weapons. So, while America's leadership in technology has hinged on having a large and dynamic economy, it has also meant managing where its most advanced products are sold. As artificial intelligence emerged as the defining technology of the 21st century, and American tech firms created chips with the world's highest computing power, the Biden administration aimed to keep the U.S. ahead by restricting sales, especially to countries such as China and Russia. The U.S. gained a critical advantage in the AI race through its ability to manufacture advanced chips, small pieces of semiconducting material that form the backbone of technology, including AI computers. But on Monday, President Donald Trump reversed years of U.S. policy by announcing that the government would allow a leading American tech company, NVIDIA, to sell its second most advanced artificial intelligence chip to approved Chinese customers. These H200 chips are far more powerful than the best China currently has. Mr. Trump's decision has sparked debate about whether the U.S. is ceding its AI advantage to China, or whether, as the administration says, the deal will make China more dependent on U.S. chips and thus slow China's efforts to make its own chips that match or exceed those made in the U.S. Mr. Trump said in a Truth Social post that 25% of the profits from the chip sales to China will be paid to the U.S. government, though he has not said how that will work. The president also said that the same approach will apply to other tech companies. The deal comes after NVIDIA's chief executive, Jensen Huang, spent months lobbying the White House to ease restrictions on exports. Administration officials say the U.S. won't be exporting its most advanced chips, but the stance appears to be shifting, since previously the U.S. had emphasized keeping as wide a gap as possible between its technology and that of other countries. This decision flies in the face of that, says Jacob Stokes, a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, an independent bipartisan think tank based in Washington. Opponents of the deal fear China will use American-made chips to learn how to build its own computer chips that can match the U.S. in computing scale. Many also accuse the Trump administration of handing away U.S. leverage for short-term profit. At stake, experts say, is which country will win what's essentially become an arms race to produce AI technology that could ultimately allow its owner to dominate global markets and gain military superiority. A change in policy on export controls. The Trump administration's deal has alarmed defense hawks, including both Republican and Democratic members of Congress, many of whom fear the technology sharing will help China modernize what is already the world's largest standing army. Beijing will use these highly advanced chips to strengthen its military capabilities and totalitarian surveillance, read a statement by the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, chaired by Republican Representative John Molinar of Michigan. NVIDIA should be under no illusions. China will rip off its technology, mass-produce it themselves, and seek to end NVIDIA as a competitor. There is also another view that aligns with the administration's strategy. John Villa Sr., a senior fellow at the center-left Brookings Institution's Center for Technology Innovation, believes the deal will ultimately benefit the U.S. Expanding the advanced chips market to China will give American companies more money to pour into AI innovation, he says. He also believes the deal will lead China to rely on U.S. chips instead of working to improve its own. If the U.S. government had continued to limit China's access to critical chips, he says, that might have ended up forcing China to supercharge its own domestic investment into chip creation. It's overly simplistic to think that by simply blocking China from accessing these chips, that's going to impede China in the AI arms race, says Mr. Villa Sr. It would have the opposite effect. Many experts point to the development of advanced semiconductor chips, such as the H200, as one of the few areas where the U.S. maintains a significant lead over China in AI development. The deal won't necessarily be a tipping factor in the arms race, says Mr. Stokes of the Center for a New American Security, but it is a significant concession that helps China deal with its biggest drawback or vulnerability on achieving advanced AI. China's drive for self-sufficiency. China, however, might not embrace the American computer chips as some experts expect. The Financial Times reported on Tuesday that China regulators have discussed instituting an approval process before companies could buy the imported chips, including giving a reason why domestic manufacturers weren't meeting their needs. Beijing already requires this for a lower-performing NVIDIA chip, the H20, that Mr. Trump permitted to be sold to China in August. Still, Reuters reported on Wednesday that Chinese companies ByteDance and Alibaba have expressed interest in buying the newer, more powerful chips. China has spent years working to reduce its dependence on the U.S. for AI development, producing products ranging from drones to chatbots. Aside from pouring money into domestic manufacturing, China has also sent messages to its own tech companies, discouraging them from using U.S. chips, particularly for government-related work. China is moving as fast as possible to build its own chips and become self-reliant in chip production, says Mr. Stokes. The idea that this deal will keep China reliant on U.S. chip production, it appears to me that the ship has kind of sailed on that. But Mr. Villa Senior doesn't see it as an either-or scenario. China won't stop investing in its own infrastructure to develop chips, he says, and they have made significant strides in building their own domestic capacity. But he says the country can't afford to lose access to U.S. chips yet. It's a long hill to climb, he says. And that completes the first article, U.S. NVIDIA Chips to China. What Does That Mean for the AI Race? By Monitor staff writer Caitlin Babcock. Our second article today is titled as U.S. Seizes Oil Tanker, Venezuelans Focus on Daily Survival. By Mi Hujaris Dahl, a contributor to the Monitor. As the United States faces increasing questions about the legality of its military pressure on Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, this week, seizing an oil tanker off the Venezuelan coast, Venezuelans inside South American nation are more focused on personal survival. On a spotty video call from her modest tin-roofed home in Caracas, Venezuela, a grandmother describes how her routines have completely deteriorated in recent years. The cost of food and transportation are increasingly out of reach for the seamstress, who is being identified by her initials, AC, for her security. Her siblings and children pitch in to keep the lights, internet, and gas on. And ever since the introduction of a government telephone application that Mr. Maduro says allows citizens to report 24 hours a day everything they see, everything they hear, AC finds herself worrying about who she can trust on the streets. It's a fear rooted in reality. She says her niece was detained for 4 months after the disputed July 2024 presidential election, which Mr. Maduro claimed he won without evidence. It was part of a government crackdown involving door-to-door raids of the homes of suspected government opponents. The United States has carried out more than 20 military strikes on suspected drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean and Pacific since early September, killing more than 80 people. It is building up its military in the Caribbean with some 15,000 U.S. troops and the world's largest aircraft carrier now stationed there. U.S. President Donald Trump has directly threatened to strike inside Venezuelan territory and announced on December 10th that the United States had seized a sanctioned oil tanker involved in an illicit oil shipping network supporting foreign terrorist organizations. It is the first known action by the administration against a Venezuela-related tanker since the military buildup. Although direct military action is at odds with international norms of non-intervention established over the past several decades, many in the region, including governments that have taken in the estimated 8 million Venezuelans who have fled growing economic, humanitarian, and political crises since 2014, are ready for a change. AC says she hopes Mr. Trump's pressure on Mr. Maduro will lead to a democratic transition. For now, she doesn't have the luxury of daydreaming about what that might look like. Her family can afford ingredients for basic meals, including meat twice a week, but there's no money left for anything else, she says. She needs dental attention but can't afford it. It makes me feel ashamed, she says. But AC is better off than many around her. Looking down from her living room window in her hilltop home, she can see children playing outside. After 5 minutes, they sit down because they don't have much energy, she says, of the effects of the lack of sustenance. A 2025 study by Caritas found nearly 80% of Venezuelan families exhaust their savings in order to eat, and more than half have gone into debt to put food on the table. Some 90% of households lack regular access to drinking water. Economic downslide. Once a regional beacon of democracy and prosperity, Venezuela began a steep political and economic decline in the 2010s. For years, late President Hugo Chavez concentrated power and expanded military influence over civilian institutions. As a drop in global air prices exposed years of underinvestment and mismanagement in the state-run oil sector, the crisis deepened under his successor, Mr. Maduro. The economy shrank by roughly three-quarters between 2014 and 2021. As Mr. Maduro's popularity slipped, the government grew more repressive, locking up protesters, activists, journalists, defecting military officers, and members of the political opposition. This week, opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who has been in hiding in Venezuela since January and has been barred by Mr. Maduro from leaving the country since 2014, took the risk of traveling to Oslo for the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. Her daughter accepted the award on her behalf as Ms. Machado reached Norway several hours later. Heightened tensions between the United States and Venezuela have put the Venezuelan government on edge, increasing repression inside the country. And cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development and other sources of funding this year have created major gaps in humanitarian response for Venezuelans in need, says Ciaran Donnelly, Senior Vice President of International Programs at the International Rescue Committee. Of 38 humanitarian organizations providing services in Cucuta, a Colombian city on the border with Venezuela, 20 are expected to close by year's end, when their funding cycle runs out. Public school teacher D.Y., who asked not to be identified by her full name due to fear of government repression, says her local soup kitchen in northern Venezuela shut down last year. Daily struggles often overshadow news about U.S. military threats, D.Y. says, partly because quality information about what is unfolding off the coast of Venezuela is limited. There's a communication blockade. People outside the country know more than those inside, she says. There isn't real information here, and a lot gets disguised. A push for change. AC prays for an end to Mr. Maduro's rule. She's hopeful U.S. military pressure could bring about change for Venezuela. I wish it could be right now, that we were done with this government, she says. For D.Y., U.S. escalation is one of the only remaining pathways to change. Last year, Venezuelans elected opposition candidate Edmundo González president with 67% of the votes, according to reviews of official voting tallies. But Mr. Maduro didn't recognize the results, claiming he was victorious. If we Venezuelans already did everything we had to do, she says of voting and taking to the streets in peaceful protest, a military option is the only way out, I see. Years of crisis have made Venezuelans resilient, D.Y. says. She keeps a small stock of food in case of an emergency, something past crises have taught her. Sometimes you have to hit rock bottom to recover and rise again, she says. Even if, for Venezuelans, it's been years of thinking, what more bottom is there for us to hit, adds AC. And that completes this article. The title was, As U.S. Seizes Oil Tanker, Venezuelans Focus on Daily Survival, by May Horatius Dahl, a contributor to the Monitor. I'm going to take a brief moment out of the broadcast to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Christian Science Monitor Daily Program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm reading the Friday, December 12th, 2025 issue of the Monitor. Continuing on with this article, Tracking Pandemic Aid Fraud. 5 years on, the toll continues to grow. By Story Hinckley, a Monitor staff writer. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, the U.S. government spent an unprecedented amount of money to prop up the economy and aid Americans whose daily lives had come to a sudden halt. Between 2020 and 2021, President Donald Trump and former President Joe Biden signed a combined 6 laws shelling out over $5 trillion, helping small businesses guarantee paychecks and paying for COVID-19 tests. The money also went toward health care and housing support, and to things like emergency food programs for children going without free school lunches. A lot of the money, it turns out, went to fraudsters. 5 years on, the total amount of pandemic relief fraud remains unknown, with estimates running from hundreds of billions of dollars to $1 trillion. While federal investigators, private experts, and even citizen sleuths continue to uncover new schemes, they say much of the stolen money may never be identified, much less recovered. The latest high-profile example came out of Minnesota, where a local nonprofit obtained more than $240 million to feed hungry children, but instead spent the money on luxury cars and real estate. Prosecutors say the sprawling Minnesota case, which continues to expand, a 78th defendant was charged late last month, is linked to a web of other massive fraud schemes, including some involving the state's housing support program, that together could exceed $1 billion. The state's acting U.S. attorney said in announcing charges this fall that the depth of the fraud feels never-ending, adding, "It takes my breath away." Many of the Minnesota defendants are of Somali descent, which has added fuel to debates over immigration policies as well as the state's social safety net, which ranks among the most generous in the country. Conservatives have excoriated Democratic Governor Tim Walz and his administration for mismanagement of taxpayer dollars and point to the state as an example of the unintended consequences of big government spending. Governor Walz, who is running for a third term next year, has defended the state's Somali community while signing an executive order to combat fraud within state programs and moving to shut down the housing program altogether. Yet while the Trump administration has made targeting government waste, fraud, and abuse a stated priority of the president's second term, experts say little is being done at the federal level to correct the systematic problem and lack of oversight that allowed so much taxpayer money to be pillaged. Lessons about pandemic spending and fraud remain relevant today as Washington debates the merits and efficacy of the welfare state and the federal bureaucracy that manages it. This month, members of Congress are considering whether to extend tens of billions of dollars in enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies that were enacted as part of one pandemic spending bill. Many congressional Republicans have been citing a recent watchdog report that found a high percentage of fraudulent accounts as a reason to let them expire. There are examples based on hard experiences from the pandemic that should be built into any response to a recession going forward, says Matt Weidiger, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, who previously worked on the House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee, which oversees unemployment benefits. One of my roles in life now is to make this argument. Don't do the stuff that was so objectively wrong during the pandemic again. We operated in a trust system. Many experts say they expected some fraud during the pandemic, given the vast sums of money being spent in a hurry. The CARES Act alone, signed by President Trump in late March 2020, sent out more than $2 trillion, making it the largest stimulus package in U.S. history. Just one part of the CARES Act, the $800 billion Paycheck Protection Program, also known as PPP, was equivalent in size to the entire stimulus package that Congress passed in response to the 2008 recession. Haywood Talcove, CEO of LexisNexis Risk Solutions for Government, a company that works with governments to detect fraud, estimates that roughly 8% of government funds are routinely stolen due to fraud. That's in line with an April 2024 report from the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, estimating government-wide fraud between 2018 and 2022 to be between 3 and 7%. But Mr. Talcove estimates this percentage went up to 20% for pandemic spending, with $1 trillion of the $5 trillion spent going to fraud. Other estimates put the fraud total in the hundreds of billions, such as a 2023 analysis by the Associated Press that suggested 10% of pandemic relief funding went to fraud, with $280 billion stolen and $123 billion misspent. Government agencies have been slow to update pandemic fraud estimates in recent years, which Mr. Weidiger attributes to embarrassment and desire to move on, given how unlikely it is the government will get much of this money back. Experts agree that the three programs in particular accounted for much of the pandemic-era fraud. The Small Business Association's COVID-19 Economic Injury Disaster Loan, or EIDL program, and PPP, as well as the Expanded Unemployment Insurance Program. In many ways, these new or expanded programs were unique to that moment in time. Government officials, both Republicans and Democrats, believed speed was of the essence to prevent economic collapse. Some guardrails were removed either intentionally or as a result of changed circumstances. Most field offices that typically verify identities for benefits were closed. The Small Business Administration, or SBA, for example, distributed $343 billion in partially or fully forgiven PPP loans to small businesses to cover payrolls and other expenses in just the first 2 weeks. This allowed many businesses to forgo immediate layoffs amid stay-at-home orders. But in the name of speed, the government let prospective borrowers self-certify that their information was valid and that their businesses actually existed. We operated in a trust system, says Mr. Talcove. He and other experts say that speed shouldn't have come at the cost of basic identification requirements. A 2023 report from SBA found that the $1.2 trillion in PPP and EIDL spending, $200 billion, or 17%, was dispersed to fraudsters. A 2023 GAO report flagged 3.7 of the 13.4 million PPP and EIDL recipients, or 27%, as potentially fraudulent. Self-certification also contributed to high levels of unemployment insurance fraud. Mr. Weidinger described this as a 1-2 punch. The Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, or PUA program, offered benefits to workers previously not covered by unemployment insurance programs, such as independent contractors and the self-employed, who were then allowed to claim retroactive benefits. Essentially, says Blake Hall, co-founder of ID.me, which partnered with some states during the pandemic to help with identification, the government allowed applicants to pinky promise that they were newly out of work. Mr. Hall cites an example out of Arizona, where his country was hired to help with identity verification for PUA claims. Half a year into the pandemic, there were hundreds of thousands of initial claims filed in a single week alone, an improbable number for a state of roughly 7 million, including children, says Mr. Hall. After ID.me services were implemented, such spikes didn't recur. The government also added hundreds of dollars onto typical unemployment checks. As a result, the reward for being a bad guy went up by record amounts, says Mr. Weidinger. Astonishing amounts of money were spent through this system that had very little in the way of identity verification, much less work verification. The bad guys quickly figured this out. The GAO has estimated that $100 billion to $135 billion of unemployment insurance, or between 11 and 15%, went to fraudsters. Mr. Hall puts the estimate closer to $400 billion, a number Mr. Weidinger agrees is likely closer to the actual number than the government's calculations. Mr. Talcove thinks the amount is somewhere in the middle, around $250 billion. The first step to fixing a problem is acknowledging it exists, says Mr. Hall. But fraud on this scale can be a hard thing for governments to admit to. No government wants to be known as the administration that lost all this money to fraud. Efforts to recover stolen funds. Some of the stolen money has actually been clawed back, but not much. As of April 2024, the Department of Justice had criminally charged more than 3,500 defendants and recovered more than $1.4 billion in seized or forfeited CARES Act funds. That's less than 1% of what was stolen from just two SBA programs alone. A congressional report from earlier this year says that the Department of Labor has recovered $5 billion in stolen unemployment insurance funds, roughly 4% of what was lost, according to the government's estimate. Since April 1, 2020, the Department of Labor's Office of the Inspector General, DOL-OIG, has opened more than 200,000 investigations into the unemployment insurance program, a thousandfold increase compared with before the pandemic, when unemployment insurance made up 11% of its case inventory. As of 2025, it is 96%. With fewer than 130 criminal investigators, the DOL-OIG has focused on large-scale theft schemes that pose the greatest risk to the unemployment insurance program. And there is a larger question of whether more can now legally be recovered. The Senate failed to vote on the Pandemic Unemployment Fraud Enforcement Act, which passed the House earlier this year, and which would have extended the statute of limitations on pandemic unemployment insurance fraud from 5 to 10 years. President Biden did sign laws in 2022 that extended the statute of limitations for tracking down fraud within the SBA's pandemic programs. A 2023 update said that almost $30 billion in EIDL and PPP funds were seized or returned, or about 15% of what was stolen. But as prosecutors continue to hunt down stolen PPP funds, experts say Washington needs to be looking forward. Even if another pandemic is unlikely, a recession may well come at some point, and many of the enhanced benefit structures that the federal government uses to prop up the economy in those circumstances are similar. Rather than the federal government just throwing additional dollars at states to distribute through their unemployment insurance programs, there should be a shared partnership, says Mr. Weidinger, with clearer lines of responsibility. Getting money to people quickly doesn't need to come at the expense of basic verifications, such as running applicants' names through the Treasury Department's Do Not Pay database, or confirming that the same individuals are not receiving unemployment benefits from multiple states. As former SBA Inspector General Hannibal Ware told the Associated Press, an extra few days of checking applications during the pandemic would not have upended the program or forced businesses to shutter. You have to have some oversight, says Mr. Talkov, and it doesn't mean that you are trying to deny a benefit. And that completes the article. The title was Tracking Pandemic Aid Fraud. 5 years on, the toll continues to grow. By Monitor staff writer Story Hinckley. The next article's title is Letter from Paris. France weighs an end to its 4-day school week. By special correspondent Colette Davidson. After more than a decade of living in France, I have learned to complain from the best. But when it comes to the structure of the French school day, you'll only hear crickets from me. Forget about the American latchkey kids of my generation. French parents can drop off their children at 8:30 a.m., still make that 9 o'clock meeting, finish their workday, and pick up the kids at 4:30, just in time for a chocolate croissant. However, when I see how difficult it is to find time for piano or gymnastics practice after the long school day, and fit in homework, dinner, and a bath before bed, I realize the flaws in the system. While the French school day allows parents to more easily work, it does not give much time for children to play. France's third Citizens Convention, consisting of 133 randomly chosen participants, has just presented its report on the structure of the French school day after 6 months of debate. The panel consulted more than 80 experts, education professionals, and youth themselves to figure out how to make the time kids spend in school more conducive to learning, development, and health. The result? 20 proposals from screen time to parental involvement that could help schools and children succeed. This is hardly the first time the French have debated the school day. It has been a hot topic for more than 25 years, garnering numerous modifications, reversals of those modifications, and implementation of the same modifications all over again. Most of the debate centers around the number of days and hours that children spend in school. France first experimented with a four-day week in the 1980s, before chronobiologists said kids needed a midweek break. In 2013, a school reform added an extra half day to the week, but today 90% of French towns are back to 4 days. Since 2013, schools have also been required to dedicate a few afternoons each week to extracurricular activities like music, sports, and art. Now the citizens' panel is proposing yet another option, the 5-day school week. They're also suggesting starting classes for junior high and high school students at 9 a.m. in order to respond to the physiological needs of adolescents, and finishing the school day earlier for everyone at 3:30 p.m. If this all sounds familiar, you might have been an American high school student in the 1990s, like me. Back then, many legislators were in debates over why teenagers were dragging themselves to the bus stop at 6:30 a.m., while elementary-aged kids, who bound out of bed at the crack of dawn, weren't starting school until after 9 o'clock. While it would be easy to brush this off as yet another example of France stereotypically coming to the table decades after the U.S., there is actually a method to the madness. The French school day has always been organized with working parents in mind. The country's 7-hour workday allows parents to be there for school pickup, homework, and maybe a hobby after school. But research shows that France's current way of doing things isn't working. Even though French children spend more time in school compared with other member countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, France placed 26th out of 81 countries, behind neighbors Germany, Belgium, and Switzerland in a 2022 PISA study that evaluated 15-year-olds' understanding of math, reading comprehension, and science. French schools also offer little in the way of structured extracurriculars, like the band, theater, or sports teams that American students enjoy. That means French parents have to pay for private classes instead. France numbers among the countries in which the public school system increases social inequalities, not reduces them, according to OECD research. Some observers blame France's academic flop on its generous school vacation schedule, which gives students 2 weeks off every 8 weeks, plus a 2-month summer break. Teachers often complain of having to start all over every time children come back from vacation. Many working parents, including my own circle of friends, loathe school breaks because they require us to find a way to entertain our children for 2 whole weeks, all while somehow keeping our jobs and our sanity. But surprisingly, the Citizens' Convention did not suggest changing the amount of school vacations, which alternate by region, all too much. The French tourism industry benefits heavily from them, as do divorced parents, who may not live in the same part of France. Instead, the panel proposed dividing vacations into 2 zones, not 3, as is currently the case, and creating a nationwide 1-week break in which everyone can benefit simultaneously. As for the shorter school day, the panel suggested creating a dedicated space for extracurriculars and homework for parents who can't pick up their children at 3:30 p.m. For those who can, that extra hour offers kids a better chance at excelling at their activity of choice. Now that the Citizens Panel has presented its report, President Emmanuel Macron and Prime Minister Sebastian Lecornu will weigh in before the report heads to the rest of the government for debate. If it's accepted, French schools could see changes as early as next year. So maybe there is hope of a little more time after school. For all I know, my hubby and I have a virtuoso pianist or champion athlete in our midst. I'm not sure what will become of my shortened workday, but if it means my kids have the chance to grow and explore and get better sleep and grades too, wouldn't it be worth it? And that completes the article, Letter from Paris. France weighs an end to its 4-day school week, by special correspondent Colette Davidson. This article's title is Rian Johnson Q&A on Faith, Knives Out, and Sesame Street Spoofs, by Stephen Humphreys, a staff writer. In a new Sesame Street skit, Cookie Monster's pie has gone missing. Enter Super Sleuth Bignett Blank. The Muppet hilariously mimics Benoit Blanc, the Southern gentleman detective played by Daniel Craig in the Knives Out movie series. But uncovering the culprit in Forks Out is a piece of cake, or pie, compared with Blanc's case in the new Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. The third Knives Out movie, streaming Friday on Netflix and rated PG-13, features a murder committed inside a room that had no one except the victim in it. Not just a whodunit, but a howdunit. For series writer and director Rian Johnson, the story is an opportunity to examine religious faith. The plot centers around the murder of a controversial preacher, Monsignor Wicks, played by Josh Brolin. Suspicion falls on his apprentice, young priest Judge Duplantisy, played by Joss O'Connor, disagreed with Wicks' vindictive and judgmental sermons. The hateful rhetoric alienated all but a faithful remnant. Only right-wing politician Cy Draven, played by Daryl McCormick, seems to find Wicks inspiring. Blaine, the detective, sporting a new shaggy hairdo, not only tries to solve the case, but also spars with Father Judd over theology. The Monitor interviewed Mr. Johnson, who also created the TV series Poker Face and directed movies such as Star Wars The Last Jedi via Zoom. The conversation has been edited for length and clarity. Rian, you have shot down the idea of doing a Knives Out movie consisting of Muppet characters. So what was your reaction to watching Forks Out, the Sesame Street spoof of your detective series? The answer, I can't remember a more joyous 3 minutes of my life than watching that. I mean, Grover said my name. Question, how does Wake Up Dead Man hold up a mirror to what you're seeing in today's religious landscape, including how that intersects with our political landscape? The answer, the basic question at the heart of the movie is, as Father Judd says, it is an arms wide versus fists up, a welcoming stance versus an us against them mentality, the idea that we're under siege and have to fight the world. That's definitely one of the very real aspects that I felt when I was part of the church. In addition to all the things that Father Judd represents of the arms open, of loving your enemies, and of helping the world. Those two things were always in conflict for me when I was in the church. It's absolutely, obviously, not just in the world of the church. That theme I can point right back at myself just in my scrollings on social media and get angry at the big them out there, with a capital T. So it's both timely and something that I've been wrestling with since I was a kid. Question. So through the process of writing the script and looking at all those tensions that you examined in a movie, did you come to any resolutions yourself through that process? His answer, for me, writing this script was a way of forcing myself to delve back into my life as a believer. I found I couldn't write this central character of Father Judd, Josh O'Connor's character, from my current perspective. I really, like a method actor, had to put myself back through the eyes of framing the world around me through a relationship with Christ. The big thing, I suppose, was reconnecting with and just appreciating love your enemy. That was the hardest assignment in the world, especially right now, and that being the thing that I find in myself today, even as a non-believer, that I need to do more of. Question. In the movie, there is that question of whether rational logic and revelation can be reconciled. So when you were writing the script about a seemingly unsolvable mystery, did you have a moment as a writer when you got stuck and you couldn't figure out a story problem, and then arrived at a solution through a seeming revelation? His answer, every writer will tell you this. We like to think that we're constructing a Lego set, or constructing a crossword puzzle, or pick your analogy. The reality is when we write, we're always deep-sea fishing, and we're always casting into deep waters. The reality is it is like in the movie, the moment of revelation sometimes when you've been working on something in the script, and suddenly the solution presents itself. I think any writer will tell you, you only get a few of them per script. So when those God rays shine through the window and you think, oh, this is what it needs to be, it feels like a revelation as opposed to the solution to a math problem. Question. In Star Wars, The Last Jedi, you introduced the idea that the Force is accessible to anyone. It's not just something for a select few. Is that a metaphor, perhaps, about faith being accessible to all, something that transcends human institutions or an investiture order? His answer, well, it's definitely what I was brought up in regarding faith. I like that notion. I like that idea. It seems to me like if there's hope in the world, that's where it's going to come from. It's not just the privileged few of a certain bloodline that get access to the basic thing that powers the universe. Question. Tell me a bit about the visual language of Wake Up Dead Men and how you and cinematographer Steve Yedlin made use of darkness and light. Answer. The first conversation I had with Steve is, I really wanted to get theatrical with the outside natural world affecting the interior spaces of the church and our sets. I grew up in Colorado where the clouds move very fast. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. And so the feeling of being in a room and having it be sunny and brightly lit, and then 2 seconds later it's like God turns the lights off. And what does that do emotionally to the tone of the room is something I felt a lot in life and don't see in movies very often. So Steve did a lot of work that we could all have the lights surrounding this church set on a light control system on his computer so that we could play it almost like music. The light changes. Question, what are some of your favorite movies that examine faith and religion? His answer, to do research when I was writing this script, my aunt and uncle in Denver, who are very Catholic, connected me with their priest, Father Scott. I went out to Denver and went to dinner with him, and he invited 5 of his priest friends. I got to have an Ask Me Anything session with like 6 young American Catholic priests. Anyway, I asked them what their favorite movie about a priest was, and they told me this movie, Calvary, with Brendan Gleeson. I watched this movie, and it is extraordinary. It's because it is not soft on the edges at all about faith. It's very much about the abuse scandal and the psychological trauma of that in Ireland. It's also a dark comedy. It's very funny, but it's hard-edged. What the priest loved about it was the central character is very human, and also genuinely trying to be a good priest, and the movie is a true look at a very hard topic. Question: how did you cast Josh O'Connor as the priest, Father Judd? Answer: I saw him in Challengers, and I thought he was great, and then I saw him in an Italian film called La Camera, where he gives a beautiful performance that is very different than the one in Challengers. I got a sense of his range, and then I sat down and met him, and just as a human being, I just felt this instant warmth and connection from him. And I just instantly felt like I think he would really bring a sincerity to this that the part relies on. So, man, I'm so grateful that we got him for this. He really is the heart and soul of the movie. And that ends the article. The title was Ryan Johnson Q&A on Faith, Knives Out, and Sesame Street Spoofs by Monitor staff writer Stephen Humphreys. And that concludes the broadcast today. I hope you enjoyed the program. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor Daily Program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading the Friday, December 12th, 2025 issue of the Monitor. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.